Something for the weekend. It's Trina Mara, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have a legend on the line, Colm Wilkinson. You're very welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Trina.
I was only saying there on social media there a few minutes ago that I was going to be talking to you, and all my friends reacted. They were like, what? Oh my God, he's such a legend. I went to see him when I was 12 at the Point Depot, and I still can't get over that voice. Les Mis, just incredible. And a lot of people, yeah, and then other people are saying, there's only one Jean Valjean, that is you. So you still get that reaction, don't you?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. And, modest here. It's very, very nice to hear that. But at the same time, you just do what you do. You do the work. And if you get that kind of sort of reaction, that's wonderful. And if you don't, you just keep on working,
Yeah,
it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool to get that. I have to say, I've seen some great Valjeans since I did it. There seems to be sort of a consensus of opinion for whatever reason. And I'm not being modest again. It's just I did what I did and I had the chops to do what I did. And whatever I did, it worked. That's it.
I just think it's so funny the way you just downplay the whole thing. I mean, you're this incredible actor, incredible voice, such a star of Broadway and the West End for how many years? And you act like as if it's nothing.
Well, I don't know. I know it's now. I'm not being derogatory here. I do get people saying it's a bit all right if that's your, what are you talking about? But I swear to God, it was work. I mean, I'm not again dismissing the fact that it was a great role. And the Phantom and it, and even Judas I did in the West End as well. But it was, just fortunate to a certain degree that I had the chops to do it. I had a great backup team, my wife Deirdre, who looked after me all the time during this stuff. It was pretty traumatic going in to do these auditions and et cetera for these gigs. But, it was just work. I think it's wonderful that they got the reaction it did. And I'm not downplaying it. I'm just saying it's sort of, I look at it from a different angle to a certain degree than punters look at it. That's all.
Would you have any idea how many shows in total you've done on a stage? Any idea off the top of your head?
Yeah, Les Mis, strangely enough, I did, I would say, a total of 1,300 shows.
Wow.
The Phantom, believe it or not, I did more. I did 1,700 of the Phantom.
God.
That's a lot of shows. Yeah. That was in 4.5 years. I did the Phantom longer than I did Les Mis, believe it or not. I refused to do Les Miserables for 10 years because Cameron McIntosh wouldn't pay me the money I wanted. So I said, I'm not doing it anymore. That's it.
Did you have a lot of bargaining power then once everyone realised how brilliant you were at it and the crowds were coming in?
He's a really cautious guy with money. Let's put it that way. He's a Scottish guy and the joke is his family tartan is a small cheque. But he's a very careful guy with money. And so he just wouldn't pay me the money. After I left Les Miserables, they made several offers for me to go to different areas and do it. That's why I didn't work for, they did the show for 10 years. And then I did the 10th anniversary concert. When I did the 10th anniversary concert, that's what made me sort of synonymous with that role. I mean, people had seen me in the theater, a lot of people had seen me in the theater, but actually go on television and go on PBS. Millions of people were seeing me overnight, and it became very popular on PBS.
Yeah.
They filmed the 10th anniversary concert in the Albert Hall, and that's what really sort of came back to bite McIntosh in the ass. He had to then employ me with the money I wanted to do that. I wasn't going back in. That was it.
Isn't it great to be able to say that, though? You know, because so many actors struggle and they're dying to get a role. And you literally could say, nope, not doing it.
Yeah, well, I could say I was with the Phantom. At the time they were asking me, I'd already gone into the Phantom. And I was earning a lot more money than McIntosh was paying me. A lot more money that he'd offered. And I said no. And fortunately enough, I was in a position to say I had some money in the bank to say no. It's a great position to be in, Trina. It's a marvelous position for an actor to be in. Unfortunately, I got to that stage. It took me a long, long time to get to that stage. where I would say, no, I'm not available.
Yeah.
Now, to be able to say that in our business is very, very strong statement.
Mm. It gives you great freedom.
The more you are unavailable, the more they want you.
Yeah, exactly. And then when it came to your roles, did the understudy get called in much, or were you more or less there the whole time?
Now, the understudies keep on asking me, stupidly enough, they're asking about my health and my welfare. They say, how are you feeling tonight? But really, they were hoping to say, well, I don't feel too good. Because
they were letting on their concern.
No, they weren't concerned about me at all. They were hoping I dropped dead or something. So they could get... That's the truth.
And cough all over you.
I'm the easiest, you know, totally easiest. You used to call me leather throat. That's what Macintosh, leather throat, because I was very, very, very off. I actually did 8 shows a week for a long time.
How did you keep the voice going, though? Because they're not like small little numbers that you're doing. These are big songs.
Yeah, they were big songs, and it was on for a long time. In fact, it was originally, it was about 3 hours long. They had to cut it. It was about over 3 hours long, and I had most of it, about 2 hours solid singing. I have no idea, Trina. I just happened to be have what I had, and I don't know how I did it. As I say, I had a great backup team with Deirdre looking after me, and I looked after myself. I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, so I looked after myself. Somebody said I was like a bloody Buddhist monk the way I used to go around. But it was the only way I could survive. Most of the time I slept. I remember in New York, this crowd wanted to come out and do a TV interview with me. And Deirdre said, well, you're welcome to come out, but you'll just have to pan the TV camera around the bed because that's where he is all day.
Yeah,
To get the energy.
That's what you need. You need to be able to say no as well, really, isn't it?
Oh, Deirdre's great. Deirdre was in television itself. You know, she was an RTE. She was a vision mixer. And her dad was a musician.
Oh, is that right?
So yeah. So she understood that Robert Murphy was a conductor, and Deirdre Murphy was a vision mixer and to RTE. So she understood the business and she understood what was going on, and she's a very, very smart lady.
Yeah.
Believe me, I know she's a very smart lady because we're now in lockdown and she's on a ring around.
I was going to say, is she sitting next to you?
No. Down in the kitchen, but she knows what I think of her. I said it before. I'm very, very fortunate that somebody has understanding and looks after me so well. I was very, very fortunate, one of those things.
And then doing the movie then with Hugh Jackman. I mean, well, I've seen some of the videos of the kind of behind the scenes things on YouTube, and that you just seem the most laid back, relaxed guy in the world. Like, this is nothing. This is like going to the shops. Actually, going to the shops is more stressful these days.
You know what? I'm an actor, I suppose. I'm sort of an actor, by the way. I'm absolutely terrified of that stuff. Yeah, absolutely terrified. I mean, opening nights are going through brick walls. I'm a very nervous performer. But you learn how to try and hide that, and you just go into the zone. And concerts are all right. You get used to it.
Yeah.
But even going down the road, even to sing a song in public, one song in public, it's always a nervous experience for me. And I just, you know, the concerts are when you go on the road and you get out and you do one or two songs, you sort of relax and you get into it. But it's always a stretch for me, nerve-wise, to do stuff like that. As regards the movie, the guy who directed it, Tom Hooper, was a real picky sort of, excuse me, pain in the arse. And he was kept on going over things and changing lines and saying, could you do this? And I said, well, give me a minute to learn. No, you have to do it now. You know, right now, the camera's there, bang, learn it, do it now. So you're under pressure all that time. He had no idea about how musicals worked, really, quite honest. And I don't think Hugh Jackman really had the chops to do well, John, to be quite honest. He could have got somebody else. But he was a lovely guy. I really like working with him, and we both have great time for each other. But
yeah.
I know 10 guys who could have sung that role much better than Hugh Jackman. But Hugh was a star, you know. So
he had the profile, yeah.
It's the old Hollywood trick again, you know.
Mm-mm. There are a lot of people in Hollywood who are great singers, though, in it, and they'd almost surprise you as well. You kind of didn't really know they were a singer, and then they bring something out.
Yeah, in the movie, I thought Annie Hathaway was great. She was great as Fontaine. She was terrific. And Eddie Redmayne made quite a good Marius. He was a nice guy, too. You know, yeah, they were all pretty nice people.
Mind you, I don't like your one Anne Hathaway. We always have a laugh at home, myself and my husband, because he loves her, you know. And every time she comes on, I kind of get a bit of a, there she is, bit of a face on me, you know. Should he ever come across her? Because it's funny,
she's
though.
A
because
nice girl. She's a nice
I'm sure
he
she is.
Does the husband fancy her?
He does, yeah. I don't get it. Don't get it at all.
Tell him, get his name and I'll put in a good word.
It's so funny though, because you know I used to do an awful lot of kind of movie stuff and interviewing all the movie stars, and you know the way they'd say, like, if you were to go out with like or kiss a really famous movie star, like who would it be? And you'd be allowed that pass from your other half, but I was never allowed it because it was quite a possibility that I would meet them. Not that I'd get to go out with them, but I could meet them, and you never know. But also, speaking of it, you're...
Who would you fancy, Trina, then?
Oh,
if your husband fancies Annie Hathaway, who would you fancy?
Oh, God, I've quite the list, really, but...
Okay.
Yeah, I was mad about Jared Butler for a while there, but I've kind of gone off him, and he was an outrageous flirt.
Really? And now I have a direct link to Jerry, if you want.
Well, I've met him, I've interviewed him, and he was absolutely outrageously flirting. Even asked the publicist to step out of the room. And I thought, am I the only one? And then I realised he's like that with everyone.
No, I've seen him in action before. He is a bit of a charmer, all right, your man. Yeah, I've seen him, all right.
Yeah, so
he played the Phantom. He played the Phantom in the movie.
Yeah,
so I was... he couldn't sing for nuts.
he looked good, even with half the face covered.
Yeah. He came on stage in Toronto. We went to see the premiere, and he said that he came on the stage. He introduced the movie, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, Colm Wilkinson is here, he said. And I know Colm quite well. And he said, Colm, before you hear this, I want to apologise.
He knows himself. He actually knows himself. He's not a great actor as well, I think. But he just kind of like has a laugh with it.
Guy. I saw him on Netflix, a very serious thing. I didn't watch it because I know Jared. He's an awful bullshitter.
Yeah, but he admits to that, you know.
Oh, he does. I tell you, he's been very successful. Very successful in the movies. Very successful guy. The real hard grafter. Jackman is a grafter, my God almighty.
Is
we used to go on the set fairly miserable at something like 6 o'clock. Well, 7 o'clock in the morning, and this car would pick you up. And the guy who was driving the car would say, this is my second call this morning. I think, who was that? He says, Jackman. He was working out in the gym from 5 o'clock in the morning. And he'd be finished at 12, 1 o'clock the previous night.
Ah, no.
I swear to God. Did you ever see his one-man show?
I've never seen it, no.
Oh my God, it's extraordinary.
Really?
Now, I mean, it is extraordinary what he does. He's just unbelievably energetic.
Yeah.
He's incredible. I mean, obviously he is what he is, but as a dancer, as an entertainer, he's amazing, yeah.
I'll get his number from you as well, just in case, you know. I'm only 2 years married, Colm, you never know. I might need another.
Okay, all right, okay. Yeah. I'm not going there. I don't want to call that. Look, if it happens, I'll give your husband Annie Hathaway's number, and I'll give your huge Jackman email if you still have.
Come here to me, Colm. You're one of 10 children. Where are you from? Because that accent hasn't gone, even though you've lived abroad for years and years.
No, absolutely not. And I don't want it to go. 68 Mangerton Road. I was born in 1944.
Say that again. Where?
Mangerton Road. Drimna.
Oh, Drimna. Okay.
Yes, didn't that?
D12.
Yeah, whatever it is, I don't know. There was no D12 when I was there.
You're back living in Ireland full time now, are you?
I am, yeah. I came back here, always wanted to come back. Myself and Deirdre always wanted to come back. We've been roaming around the planet for the last 50 years.
Mm.
We always wanted to come back to Ireland. That was the end goal, and that was when we achieved it about 2 years ago. And then this rubbish came down the road. And we were really having a great time, loving being home and meeting all the people again and going on trips down the country. And it was great, really fantastic.
Yeah.
And then this crap happened. So
yeah.
Hopefully it'll blow over, I hope. I'll just start drinking or get on those tablets that idiot Trump is on. And
oh,
see
yeah.
What happens.
Apparently they make you go bald, though.
So. Look, I'm already nearly there, so it doesn't matter.
What have you been doing then to pass the time during this blooming COVID?
Well, I was mixing down the track in Harker Street. I went in about 6 months ago, 7 months ago, into a studio called Jellistown. And Jellistown Studios, and I put down four tracks. For the first time in my life, Trina, I'm independent of commercial objectives, if you know what I mean, commercial agendas or commercial ideas.
Yeah.
I don't need to do any of that stuff. I wanted to do my own stuff my own way, and there was no radio play going to be involved in it. There was none of that idea about it. And I put down four tracks, and one of them was Harker Street.
Yeah.
And that was the one we mixed down first, and it turned out quite nice. People like it, and it's now up on whatever iTunes and Spotify and all that stuff, and it's getting a lot of action actually.
Yeah, and Harcourt Street, when you moved back and you took a little stroll down Harcourt Street, and it reminded you of going there years ago. Where did you used to go on Harcourt Street years ago? No doubt it was long before Copperface Jacks.
Oh, absolutely. Copperface Jacks. People keep on talking about that. I don't even know where that is.
Oh, come here. When it's back open, we'll have to get you in there. It's an experience
no
and a half.
Where it is and what it is. Yeah, I'll tell you about Harcourt Street. There was a ballroom there. By the way, the station in Harcourt Street, believe it or not, somebody just texted me. I think it was my son. He said, by the way, Dad, that Harcourt Street thing that you wrote. The station there was designed by a guy called Wilkinson.
Oh, really? The Garda station?
An architect. No, the police station, the train station.
Oh, the trains. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Designed by, and he designed Bray, and he designed a couple of more. A lot of, in the 18th century, he got a lot of workhouses and a lot of stations. He joined Bray Station. He designed, he's an architect. Anyway, I'm getting away from facing that station, before that red brick monstrosity went up there facing the station, and there was a ballroom called the Four Provinces, and it turned into a place then called the TV Club, and eventually I was playing in there as a young guy, about 15 years of age, with a guitar, 16 with a band. I was 16 the first time I flew out. I keep on saying this, and I can't believe it myself at times. I was 16 years of age, and I flew. The first trip I ever made was straight out of Dublin on a plane, straight out of Dublin into New York. That was first trip I ever did on a plane.
Gosh.
And I was with a band, and we did various places like in New York and Chicago ballrooms and different things like that. But that was the place I started to play with bands, in that place in Harcourt Street in the Four Provinces. And then later on down the road, right at the bottom at the Stephen's Green's end, there's a place called the Five Club. Some guys who were as old as me would remember the Five Club. It was where all the beat guys used to play. And I was with a band called The Action. And I was the singer, and a guy called Ian McGarry, who's an RTE, was the drummer. And Brian Lynch was the bass player, and Ken Rigby was the guitar player. And we had it was a good band called The Action. It was, the music had sort of just transferred. It's, our music had changed, let's say, from this jukebox sort of stuff that, that all these bands were doing into James Brown and blues, sort of out and out rock and roll. That was the stuff we played and we always wanted to play.
Yeah.
So that's where I ended up doing that stuff in the Five Club. So that's the association with the music for me. And a lot of guys I met in that club, and a lot of, I would say, ladies, not a lot. I was never Brad Pitt. I was never...
Jared Butler.
I was never Jared Butler, no. I wasn't the Rudolph.
Jared must be beside you again, is she?
No, she's not. She's actually down the street. She's not as well. Just a very shy individual I was. He used to call me Solemn Column.
Yeah, I doubt that very much.
Well, I was. Yeah. It took a long time for me to... when I performed initially, I used to get up at the Interval in these tennis clubs that I used to dance in. Percy's up in Reynolds, I used to dance in there. I'd get up at the Interval, and this guy would play the guitar, would borrow the guitar from the guitar player, and I'd sing Come On Everybody.
Yeah.
Eddie Cochran's song called Come On Everybody.
Come
with
on,
my back
everybody. That one?
Yeah. Good for you. He's a great guitar player and a great singer. I liked him rather than Elvis Presley, going on. He was my favorite guy. Presley, I never really got to terms with, even though I met him and all that kind of
stuff. Oh, would you stop, did you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Elvis came to see a band I was with. And, you not know that story?
No, I didn't know this one. No.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me this one.
I was out in the Bahamas. Look, I like black singers, you know. I wasn't listening to Elvis Presley. I was listening to Little Richard. I was listening to Fats Domino. Little Richard was just the best. I saw him in Rock Around the Clock when I was 11 years of age, and it just blew my mind. And he just died there about a month ago. An incredible.
That's right,
singer,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Little Richard. So that's who I was listening to. And I never really had time for Presley and that. Though I did like That's All Right Mama, and the first album he released with Sun Records that that guy did in the Sun Studios, Sam Phillips did. I liked that stuff. But once he went into the other stuff, it was sort of, he's a white guy trying to sound black. Sam Phillips was looking for a guy, a white guy to sound. Elvis Presley never sounded black.
No.
People keep on saying he was a white crossover. He ripped off all their movements and gyrations and songs. Like, That's All Right Mama was written by a guy called Craddock, Big Boy Craddock, if you want to look it up.
Yeah.
And he used to listen to him sing. He used to go and watch him actually down in Memphis. Yeah, and he went in a lot of the choirs and stuff like that. Anyway, cut a long story short, I'm down in the Bahamas in Paradise Island Hotel. I'm with a band called The Witnesses. We're doing three shows a night in this lounge. Popular, there's a lot of people coming to hear the band. They like the band. And who moves down but Presley after his first stint in Vegas? And he's upstairs in the penthouse. And your woman Priscilla's coming down every night with her entourage of women, three or four women knocking around with her, as well as your man who had the Memphis Mafia with him. But he was living up in the top in the penthouse and very rarely came out. And she said one night, she's come down, I've got to get Elvis down to see the band. I've got to get Elvis down to see the band. And we said, that'd be great if you get him down to see the band. Yeah, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. That's the guys. I wasn't that interested. Mm. Quite honest. I know it sounds mad, but I wasn't. I just wasn't. And I was more interested in listening to the Bahamian guys singing. However, he did come down one night. He came down and he was sitting just on about 10 feet away at a table. And he was roaring laughing at the jokes that this guy, one of the comedians in the band, he messed around. He did an impersonation of Presley doing Heartbreak Hotel, shaking his legs around and did all that. One of the guys in the band, your man was killing himself laughing.
Yeah.
Anyway, after the gig, the guys went to see him, and I swear to God, it wasn't being derogatory, it wasn't being dismissive. I had something to do, like somebody to meet, or I'd made.
You were washing your hair, Colin, were you?
I was washing the bit I had. Yeah, I was. I was watching. Oh, yeah, I was. I went off, and the guys were talking about meeting them and blah blah blah. But I was coming down the next day to put my guitar into the lounge because we did three shows. Did an early show, sort of a mid, and then a late show. And you put the guitars, the instruments, you tune them up, and you put them on the stage for the gig, you know. And he was in the foyer with the Memphis Mafia, and he spotted me, and he came over. He walked over. I was sort of looking at him because he was walking towards me, and I had the guitar, and he was looking at me. And I thought, he must be coming over, or maybe he's not coming up. But he actually came over to me, and he said, "You've been able to lose your singing, man, beautiful man." That was going on, you know. And I swear to God, this is what I said, and people still don't believe this. It was going on so much about the joy of the song. I actually sang "I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen," because it was that kind of band. You had to do a bit of Irish stuff. And he recorded that song 3 months later.
Oh, God.
He recorded that song 3 months later. Anyway, he said it was a beautiful band. And I said, "Oh, great, folks, we were talking about different things." This is, by the way, I was giving singing lessons up in room 346 or something like that. And he sat laughing. It was a great crack. And he was a very, very nice man. He was a really nice guy.
He probably loved the fact that you weren't a bit impressed by celebrity or the fact that he was famous, and you'd probably treated him a bit differently to other people who were all falling over him.
He wasn't huge at that time. He just came out of the army. I think he'd done one stint in Vegas. And it's 1970 now we're talking. So he wasn't that big at that. He hadn't really exploded doing the Vegas thing with the high collar and all that.
Yeah, but he knew it was coming, probably. He knew it was coming.
Well, he was trying to make a comeback at that time, and he still had the high collar on. And my sister used to have photographs of him up on the wall, and I just say, what are you listening to that greaseball for, you know? And she'd go mad. He's not a greaseball, he's a very good looking guy. But actually when I did meet him, he was, even with the dyed hair, he was a very good looking dude. He was a good looking man.
Yeah,
that's for sure. And
you'll give him that, will you?
Good looking. What?
You'll give him that at least.
I think he was a great singer for what he did, and his presence on stage was amazing. And what he did with that trio when he started off with Heartbreak Hotel, Scotty Moore and the other guy on drums,
yeah,
Fontana on drums, the bass player, was amazing sound. But it was white for me, that's all. That was it.
Oh.
Anyway, he was a very nice man. I enjoyed talking to him, and I was delighted to meet him.
Yeah.
And I was very sad to watch his slow demise with drugs and all that stuff. Because when I saw him, he was squeaky clean, and he was he was never squeaky clean. He was always on Benzedrine. But he was slim. He was really good looking. He was in the best health he could be in. He was always on Benzedrine, you know, that guy. He was always on drugs, like Jerry Lee Lewis and all those guys, Johnny Cash. They were all on Benzedrine, those guys, I'm sure. Anyway, there you go. That's the Elvis Presley story.
Your guess. Listen, Colm, I could talk to you for hours. Your stories are absolutely amazing, and I'm so delighted to have gotten you on the show.
Well, you're very kind and patient to listen to all this drivel that I come out with. But there you go. It is what it is. It sort of happened, and I sometimes look back on it and think, you know, I mean, it was work, but there was some good stories in there. The best story of all is that I raised 4 kids through it all, and still with my wife, and we're still reasonably happy. Sometimes the way she looks at me now these days, because we've been together for 2 months. It's like, I'll tell you this joke, and then I go, the two women talking, and one says to the other, where's the husband? And the other one says, he's out in the garden. She says, I don't see him. She says, you have to dig a little.
Yeah, I was just, you know what? I was just about to say to you, if she spends too much time out in that garden, you know she's digging your grave. Come here, do you ever have a bit of a sing song in the house now during this lockdown? Are you into that?
It's very hard because I'm so sort of, it's really ripped my head up, to be quite honest. And I know a lot of people. I was looking at this guy who wrote Les Miserables the other night, Jean-Claude. They were on Schoenberg. They were on a Zoom thing. They asked me to join. I wouldn't join it. I don't know people talking like that. Anyway, he was saying that he can't even go near the piano anymore because he just feels so upset. I'm sitting like that. No, I do go down on the guitar, and I do, but promoting this single has taken me, you know, a lot of time and effort and stuff like that. But I'm also dealing with some other stuff. I have 4 kids all over the world, right now. They're in different parts of the world. Which
oh,
I
are they? Oh, yeah,
about,
okay.
Yeah.
It's very hard. You know, you don't know when you're going to see them next.
Now, it does worry me. It worries me. Like, I've had a life as such, and they're, you know, they're not exactly teenagers, but, you know, I just wonder what the future will be like for them. So I get a bit upset about that, I have to say. So it is. It's tough. I'm sure, you know, we're all in the same boat, and I'm actually quite lucky or quite fortunate. I have a little house, the garden, and Deirdre and I have a walk around, have another understanding, and she's a very patient woman. So, you know, I'm very, very fortunate. So I should be counting my blessings, but I find it difficult sometimes. I do find it difficult,
Each day at a time, Colm. That's all we can do, isn't it?
Yeah. No. I'm very, very fortunate. I'm really, really fortunate. Mm. Yeah, I am. I do go down with the guitar, and I drag it out, and I sing, and I do some things, and et cetera, because when you stop, at my age, you have to sing every day to keep your voice up, and I'm not doing that. But I wish, I'm going to try and persevere a bit more, because the singing does relieve a lot of tension and stuff.
Yeah.
Music is great for the soul.
Oh, amazing,
music is
great
for the soul.
Where would we be without it?
Exactly.
I wouldn't have a job, for
after,
sure.
You look after the Annie Hathaway friend, and I'll talk to Jared about you, okay?
Thanks a million, Colm, and the best of luck. The new single is out now. It is called Harcourt Street. You take care of yourself, won't you?
All right. Thanks for talking to
me. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
This is something for the weekend. It's Classic Hits.